On this week's 51%, we speak with artist Allison Cornyn about a new exhibit remembering the lives lived and lost at the site of the former New York Training School for Girls.
There's all of these artists that are doing this incredible work around the earth and around loss, and how important it is to try and acknowledge things that have happened so we can move forward in a way that leaves nobody behind.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Our guest today has, for years, been researching the history of a prison in Hudson, New York. Now a medium-security prison for men called Hudson Correctional Facility, the site used to be the New York Training School for Girls. And even before that, it was the Women's House of Refuge. In the time that it was the New York Training School, from 1904 to 1975, it was one of the largest reformatory schools, or juvenile detention centers, for girls in the country. Girls throughout New York State who were considered incorrigible or ungovernable were sent there, including a young Ella Fitzgerald in the 1930s. Artist Allison Cornyn has worked on multiple projects detailing the site's history and telling the stories of its former residents in an effort to highlight the ways in which we punish or outright criminalize independent girls. Her interest, she says, began with the discovery of a box of records and a story about a little-known cemetery on the prison's campus. Cornyn's latest exhibit, called Unearthing the Light, pulls together the work of 17 artists exploring the site's legacy, the neglect and erasure of marginalized bodies, and the importance of remembrance. It's on view now at the Church in Statsburg, an artist residency space and venue that Cornyn owns. I recently spoke with Cornyn to learn more about her work, the group Incorrigibles, and the New York Training School. Just a heads up to our listeners that today's conversation does mention child abuse and sexual assault. Not in detail, but if that subject is triggering for you, this may not be the conversation for you. If you or someone you love has been impacted, Child Help has resources available 24/7 by calling or texting HELP to 1-800-422-4453.
I have been working for many years on a project called Incorrigibles about the history of young women's incarceration. And that project started through an investigation into the prison in Hudson called Hudson Correctional Facility. It opened in the late 1800s as the Women's House of Refuge. And then from 1904 to 1975, it became the New York State Training School for Girls, which is basically a euphemism for a youth prison for girls. And the most famous person that was there was Ella Fitzgerald, the singer. Mm-hmm. So a thrift shop owner in Hudson bought a box of documents for $5 at a yard sale. And they were all documents from the New York State Training School, letters home, personal photographs, intake forms, all kinds of images and documents that had been spirited out of the institution. So with those, I put together the stories of the girls. Turns out they were all from the New York State Training School from the 20s and 30s. I put their stories together and then started trying to understand what's changed and not in youth justice for girls and sharing those stories online. So Incorrigibles has been a long-term project. Each summer we get together women who were formerly incarcerated at the institution. We do workshops, intergenerational workshops with young women. And then we gather together. Some years ago, I had been on the grounds of the prison because I had read through a book that Nina Bernstein did. She was a writer for The Times, who also did a book called The Lost Children of Wilder about the history of foster care. And not just the history, but a major legal case around foster care in New York, with the major plaintiff was Shirley Wilder. And Shirley had run away. And when she ran away, she stumbled onto the cemetery. So knowing that there was a cemetery there, I had asked the superintendent if I could photograph the cemetery. And so I was able to go there and photograph the cemetery where there were headstones of babies and girls. There's no dates, just names. Some of them are so old that the names are rubbed off. Some of them were falling down. It was kind of derelict. And I had been haunted by that cemetery. And so last summer, I had asked, as part of what we were doing with Incorrigibles and through our support from Humanities New York and the Mellon Foundation, to see if we could organize a memorial ceremony at the cemetery. And so it took a while to get permission through the Department of Corrections, and but we were able to do that, and it was quite beautiful. The mayor of Hudson came and spoke really eloquently, and he talked about how he hadn't known that this cemetery was even in Hudson. And there was a woman named Amanda Krish who did a dance in the cemetery. Some of the women who had been at the training school kind of spoke about their four sisters. And Reverend Singletary, who is a local reverend in Hudson, kind of closed everything out with a prayer. And we left white roses by the gravestones. And so I was thinking, well, this summer we're going to get together again, and we're going to do intergenerational workshops. And we know that we can use this church as our home base. And I was thinking about what could an exhibition be this year. And I thought, well, it should kind of take off where last summer left off. You know, we ended with this memorial ceremony to honor the girls and babies who are buried at that institution that people don't really know about. And the plan was also to do some genealogical research with young women to A, learn how to do genealogical research as a skill, and also to see if we can find more information on who these babies and girls were, because it's possible that we can reach out to their family members, because we don't know if they even know that they're there.
How many people were buried at the cemetery?
From what I understand, most of the girls and babies buried there are probably from when it was the House of Refuge for women. The last recorded burial was in the 30s, though, I think 1933. And so that was when it was the New York State Training School for Girls. We know there are 14 girls and babies that are buried there. One of the things that I want to hopefully get permission to do and to is and I've begun to reach out to look for a forensic anthropologist to see if there's a way to get permission to bring in ground penetrating radar, which is not invasive at all, but to see if there's the possibility of other bodies that might be there. Because my guess is they're finding more and more of these institutions around prisons where people were buried, and it's usually many, many more than there are headstones for. I don't think that this cemetery at all is like the mass grave cemetery at the Dozier School for Boys that the Nickel Boys was written about and the film was based on. But I do think there probably are other babies and girls buried there, and I don't think anyone should ever be forgotten. The other plan has been to create ultimately an off-site memorial in somewhere in Hudson, like maybe overlooking the Hudson River. Because the cemetery is on prison grounds, it's very difficult to get access. If a family member wanted to, I'm sure they could go through the Department of Corrections, I'm sure, and get permission and all that. But in general, to be able to kind of constantly have a memorial to honor these girls and babies, I think the goal would be to have something that's more public in Hudson.
Do we know how they died?
Yes, because there's some of the death records were located, and we have Anna Louise Schaberger, who died May 7th, 1892, when she was at the House of Refuge for Women. She was a baby. Her cause of death was pulmonary congestion, which is basically fluid in the lungs. Mary O'Brien died September 26th, 1892, of tuberculosis. Julia Kuhn was Irish and German. Died in June 9th, 1893, and she died in childbirth. So I believe her baby is also there. I'm still trying to understand how babies were treated at those institutions, and it changed over time. At some point, the girls who gave birth were allowed to keep their babies for a little while. I think very often they were sent to either a family member or maybe went to an orphanage. I know in later years, you know, sometimes they went to like Catholic charities and things like that until the girls got out, or they'd end up in foster families forever. But going back to this, Mary O'Brien was 18 years old when she died. Nellie McGovern died at 18 from syphilis. Helen Peer died at 21 of syphilis. So those are the death records that we've been able to access. And so there's much, much more research to do. But the fact that we even have this is kind of amazing.
What was the facility like back then? You know, I guess way back when it was the House of Refuge, and then we can chat about the New York Training School for Girls.
Since most of my research has been about the New York State Training School for Girls, I'm not sure what the facilities were like. When the House of Refuge opened, it was opened as a facility for women, and it brought over this cottage system from England, which was basically a carceral system for women, since women, they thought, should be in community. You know, they would set up these cottages where there was meals would be prepared together, eaten together. If there was education, it would happen all in the cottage. And there would be basically different rooms. You know, each person would have their own room, tiny room. That's how it's been maintained. We were able to get a tour last summer because the women who had been at the training school actually wanted to go back. You know, they were trying to remember what it was like. So women were sent there for, you know, being wayward, I think, for prostitution, sex work, for, I think, you know, in some cases, those institutions were, you know, they were places that women were sent because they wanted to protect men from venereal disease. They thought that women were, you know, spreading that. When it came to the New York State Training School for Girls, the intake books basically say, you know, they use these terms like they were sent there for being wayward, again, ungovernable, that's Ella Fitzgerald, incorrigible, which is why the project is named that, you know, unable to be reformed or corrected. What I realized when I pieced together the stories, you know, based on the materials in the box, was very often the girls were sexually or physically abused, and they were the ones that were sent away rather than the perpetrators of abuse. And so in some cases, I think it was a way to silence the girls. In some cases, there was abusive homes, and sometimes girls were doing what girls still do today sometimes, run away from home, you know, don't go to school. And we're beginning to ask now when a girl runs away or doesn't show up at school, like, why? Like, why are you running away? What are you running away from? But very often back then, it's like, you're running away, you have to be punished. And not thinking about, you know, that maybe running away is for self-preservation. With the interviews that I've done with women who are still alive, who are there, you know, they talked about one woman, Hilda, who she had run away from home because her mother attempted to kill her. And then she ended up moving in with this guy, got pregnant with his baby, and then had no place to live, tried to go back to her mother. And her mother said, I don't want you. I don't want this baby. Baby went to Catholic Charities. Hilda went to the training school at 15. And turns out while she was there, she was sexually abused by that house father, because the cottages were set up with these house mothers. If they were married, sometimes there'd be a house mother and house father. That's another thing that's grown out of this project is Heather Greer and I had just finished a film about Hilda. It's called Hilda O versus the State of New York, because Hilda sued New York State because of the abuse, and she just got a settlement, which is an amazing feat and acknowledgement, despite the fact that she'll never, you know, be able to be compensated for suffering all that abuse. But for Hilda, it was so important to be heard and believed that this abuse happened.
When was this? When was Hilda there?
Hilda was there in the 50s.
And how old is she now?
83 years old. She just got the settlement.
Wow.
The film is called Hilda O versus the State of New York. It's a 16-minute short documentary. And we just premiered it at the Rain Dance Film Festival in London.
I was never bad. I was not bad. I should have never been put in that home. I'm just here to tell the truth.
We've submitted it to some film festivals in the States. And then after it's in film festivals, we want to do community screenings with organizations working to end statutes of limitation for sexual abuse, which only serve to protect abusers, and also to bring attention to the fact that this kind of abuse happens today still in institutions, very often where there's this imbalance of power and kids really have to, you know, should be protected.
We're speaking with Allison Cornyn, artist and curator of the exhibit Unearthing the Light, now on view at the church in Statsburg, New York. It's tied to her work researching the New York Training School for Girls, which is now Hudson Correctional Facility in Hudson, New York, and a cemetery on the site. The New York Training School was open for a long time, over 70 years. How did it change in that time? What was it like for girls living there?
They changed over time. They In the 20s and 30s, they were segregating the black girls in two of the cottages. There was a class action lawsuit, or that the NAACP filed to end that. And it was supposed to end, but I don't think it ended for many, many years after that. And the story behind that, I think, is important to be told because it shows how important it is for every person to be aware of what's happening around them and to do whatever they can to try and remedy injustices. Because there was, apparently, there was a radio show where there was a doctor. His wife heard this radio show, and it was talking about this institution up the Hudson where black girls were being segregated and not treated well. They actually had a yacht, and they would use it on the weekend sometimes to go up the Hudson. And one weekend, they just decided to dock in Hudson and ask the superintendent for a tour of the facilities. And so he witnessed, or they witnessed, that really the black girls, their cottages, they had many less amenities. Not that the white girls' cottages had many amenities, but also they were having to do all the laundry for the entire institution and things like that. So he then wrote a letter to the governor at the time. And there's a copy of this letter. Jeff Ward wrote a book about the Black Child Savers along the Hudson, and he's the one that shared this letter, which is so incredible. And he starts like, "Dear Governor Lehman, I brought something to your attention once before, and I have a new issue. My wife heard this radio program, and I visited this place, and it's completely, it needs to be remedied because the black girls are being treated." And that, so then Governor Lehman somehow got involved, and then the NAACP did their lawsuit, and that had to change. I think over the years, they used solitary confinement quite a bit. And, the girls would be sent, very often to a dark room without anything. And then if they were good enough, they could get, a mattress. And if they were a little, good for longer, they could get a blanket. And at one period, Kathleen Hulser is a public historian that's been working with me for many years. She's passed away last year. But Kathleen was, she was, when she was researching, she found that they were using asafoetida, which is kind of like a soap that kind of makes you gag. And it's, for if people were arguing or if they were using bad language, they would, put that in their mouth. From what I understand, when Ella Fitzgerald was there, there was a choir, but she wasn't allowed to sing in the choir because she was black. There's a chapel on the grounds. The girls actually created their own kind of language that they could speak to one another with that the people working there weren't supposed to understand. And partially it was to kind of hide these relationships that they were creating. They would use code words and acronyms like Holland is hope our love lasts and never dies. There was this whole intricate system of relationships. It was called the racket, or that's what this sociologist named Rose G. Lombardo called it when she was studying there, and they talked to her about it in the 50s or 60s. But there are these family structures that would be created. And if two girls were going to get married, their mother and father would have to, give their blessing. And then there was other kind of symbolic gestures, like in the when they went to chapel, if a Bible dropped and two girls stood up at the same time, that was a marriage. And so there were all kinds of ways to communicate. Using song lyrics was another way that they would communicate. And very often the girls would take names when they got there, not their real names, and they would, go by these other code names. And sometimes, they tried to stop this, but some of the girls, wore two pairs of socks to make their ankles look thicker because they wanted to be, male presenting, and the institution was always trying to stop these kinds of things. But the girls were, very often would be getting away with it. From what I've learned in speaking with women who were there and family members of people who were there, in most cases it was a very punitive place. There wasn't a lot of education happening. It was a training school, but they would learn, sewing, cooking, cleaning kinds of skills. But in some cases, people talked about how they had a house mother that was loving, that really supported them, that taught them things. There was a man named Staley Keith who was there, and a few of the women have talked about him. He was the gym teacher. He would bring newspaper clippings all the time to share with them. This was like in the 60s, to talk to them about things happening in the civil rights movement. Some of the women really learned about kind of politics and what was happening in the world through him. And he also, one woman was there, Lily, she was getting beat up a lot by other kids, and he taught her how to fight so she could, protect herself.
Well, let's talk about Unearthing the Light. As you mentioned earlier, it builds off an exhibit you did last summer at the church called Incorrigibles. Who have you called in to help with this year's project, and what kinds of artwork can visitors expect?
The one piece that's the same from last summer and this summer that's in are the photographs that I took of the cemetery that kind of started this whole thing. There's one photograph of the cemetery in the distance with all the headstones, and it's since been the Department of Corrections has put a new fence in, and the headstones are standing up, so it has been taken care of better. And then Heather Greer and I, we collaborate on film projects together. We made a minute and a half clip of the piece where Amanda is dancing in the cemetery. So those two pieces are kind of the bridge between last summer and this. And then I invited artists. It turns out there's 17 artists altogether. I was thinking about artists that are dealing with marginalized bodies, bodies that have been neglected because of race or poverty or gender. And then kind of expanding that, well, thinking about the bodies that are buried in the earth, but also artists that are working around the earth as a body of neglect, but also as a place of potential healing. One of the first pieces that I thought of and I reached out to is an artist named Gillian McDonald, because I had been to an exhibition that she had done a few years ago, and she was working on black holes and roots. And so I was thinking about her root drawings, which are very striking, and they take her weeks and weeks and weeks to do. They're all done by with pencil or with ink. They're so hard to explain, but they really do make you feel like you're in the earth with these roots. There's another dance piece in the exhibition, Jasmine Hayes. I was introduced to her, and she's got two pieces in the exhibition. One is it's an embossed paper, and it looks like braids, but it looks like kind of a genetic spiral. It's called Code, and she's thinking about genetic codes and how you process familial history and things through genetic codes. She also had a residency in Mosaic, where she was thinking about her African American history, and she did a dance partially in a church. She's inside and outside, but she's using different materials like cornmeal and rose petals and things. So there's, and that kind of mirrors the, Amanda's dance from the cemetery. But it was also so interesting that the exhibition's in a church and she's also dancing in a church. Nina Sobel, she's a very well-known video artist from the 70s. And Nina's somebody who I've known on and off. She had had something at her apartment a few years ago that I'd gone to. And I was thinking about, I remember she had sent an announcement about a book that she was doing, and it was called Unseen, Unheard. And I was like, I should look at that again and see what exactly that is. And it's a limited edition book. The book is made, it's not a bound book, but it's made in a box with these individual pages. It's a book made from screen grabs from a video. And the idea behind it is that I think she made it around COVID. It was that there was something that came as a blight upon the earth. And then you see through the video that very abstractly that there's this destruction that happens. And then there's kind of a rebirth at the end. But it's so much more than that. It's because it's very abstract and very beautiful video. And it's dedicated to Corey. And I think she'd be okay with me sharing this because it's in the exhibition. But when I went to her studio to pick up the elements, the book and the video to put in the exhibition, I originally was just going to put parts of the book in. But then she asked about the video, and it makes sense because you can see the connection between where the book comes from. And then I saw there was a tiny little sculpture on a shelf along with many other sculptures of hers, but it was this small. A small little head. And I said, Nina, what's that head is so beautiful. What is that head? And she said, that's Corey. And I said, who's Corey? And I hadn't even seen the video that was dedicated to Corey. And she said, Corey is my daughter. She died when she was 4 and a half, because when she was a baby, she had a blood transfusion, and it was infected with AIDS. And so Corey ended up dying very young because she got AIDS as a tiny little baby. And a lot of the projects, or some of the projects that Nina has done, are dedicated to Corey, because that's really not something that you just never can get over. So she said, "I think I have some other things that I made, and other body parts of Corey." And so she showed me these two little legs, and she said, "Do you want to put those in the exhibition?" And I said, "Yes, please," because they really, it's so resonant with these girls and babies that are just kind of were buried in the cemetery and forgotten. It's the idea of little beings that die, and we try to protect them, but you can't.
Yeah. Well, Allison, thanks so much for joining us today. What do you hope people most take away from Unearthing the Light?
That's a great question. Thinking about how many ways there are to honor life, and having people be aware of the cemetery, and understanding that there's all of these artists that are doing this incredible work around the earth and around loss, and how important it is to try and acknowledge and memorialize things that have happened so we can move forward in a way that leaves nobody behind. There's one of the artists, Ophelia Mangan, and Ophelia, she has these beautiful pieces in the exhibition. They are origami flowers. She has these little white pieces of paper, and with a prompt, "I remember," and you can write down something that you remember. It's almost like a prompt of a memorial. She asks you to roll it up, and that becomes the center of, with many of those other rolled up slips of paper, they become the center of these flowers that she makes, these origami flowers. She also did a seed ball workshop where you take clay and seeds and soil and mix them together. And it's called memoriam, because the idea is that when you're doing this mixture and creating these balls, you're remembering someone or something that you want to memorialize. You take your little dried seed balls away, and then you're free to throw them someplace and have these flowers grow, which is a way to honor and remember whoever or whatever it is that you want to not be lost.
Allison Cornyn is an artist and curator at the church at Statsburg. She's also the artist behind the project Incorrigibles, working with former residents of the New York Training School for Girls. You can learn more about the exhibit Unearthing the Light at the church's website, thechurchstatsburg.org. To learn more about the short documentary Allison mentioned, Hilda O versus the State of New York, go to hildaoversusnewyork.com. Allison, thanks again.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk.
For listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio, based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at WAMC.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. Lost my cool, no electricity. Hot rain on the concrete. Sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, "Oh, I want a big life, not a house that could have been like. Where are you taking me? Where are you taking me?"